Hey everybody, join us as we delve into our favorite dark tales and paranormal mysteries.
Venture with us beyond the safe places that exist in daylight as we go
beyond the shadows. True crime.
Paranormal.
Hauntings.
UFOs.
Cryptids and unsolved mysteries.
Conspiracy theories.
Past lives.
Reincarnation.
And all the like are just a few of the topics that we will tackle.
If it haunts your fucking dreams, then it will be on our show.
Shadows where you found me at. You can't see me in the deepest blacks. When your heart starts racing and you see the cracks, all these creepy things that you might attract. All the demons be where the action's at. So listen up if you want it. UFOs, all them ghosts, we got everything that you want. Whoa.
Do you know what the most frightening thing in the world is?
Hello everyone, and welcome back to Beyond the Shadows, episode 82.
Welcome back, Shadow People.
So before we get started, we get a couple of quick corrections from last
yes.
week. So it was pointed out to us. Me and Scott knew. We knew when we were covering the story. We both thought that weed was legal in California, but the news story that we were covering said it was not. So,
and it is. Heather from Like Mother Like Murder set us straight with the quickness. She's like, the sticky icky is very much legal.
I got a bag full on my table right now. She didn't say that.
And I bought it on the corner.
It was implied.
She hinted towards it. But there was also another correction, too. We didn't just fuck up once.
No, we fucked up twice. So don't,
which is less than normal, I think.
Don't get your news from us. Just FYI.
Take our news with a grain of salt, please.
So the lady living on the roof that we covered, which is a fascinating story.
I love that.
So the article that we read, it simply said Midland. It was in Midland. So I assumed it was Midland, Texas. I looked up a couple other sources, and it was not. It was Midland, Michigan.
Shit. Did we get anything right?
No.
No. Wasn't there a third story?
There was a lady on the fucking roof.
She did have a couch, I think.
Most of that was accurate.
I actually saw that story again. She had a computer in there. And
she did. Yeah. She had way more than we covered. Yeah, there was a lot of stuff.
I found another article. And it had listed a lot more stuff.
I'm impressed.
Yeah, I was too.
So we also wanted to mention that as of this week, we were on the Uncomfortable podcast with Eric and Where the Weird Ones Are with Kevin.
Yeah, those two were great. Me and Ryan were both interviewed by the both of them, and the episodes are really good. I like them a lot. Yeah,
we're both real nice guys. Amazing shows. We had a great time. So
yeah, if you guys want, we were interviewed in both of them. You want some fire pit stories from us? That's pretty much a. There's some long. I don't think we covered the same thing. Maybe a little bit over the two, a little overlap, but there's a lot of new stories on there.
Yeah, we cover a lot of our background with the with paranormal and how we get introduced to it.
So
our experiences.
If you haven't gone through every episode and you missed something, which you should have, it was in your homework assignment. But go check those out. Either way, the guys are great. The podcasts are fantastic. Go check them out. It's the Uncomfortable podcast, and it's Where the Weird Ones Are.
Very much worth your time. We highly recommend. So in the news this week, so we got a lady in Colorado. So she was released from jail for car theft on May 3rd. So she just released.
Just out the door.
She walks up the road from the jail, and she spots a truck with the keys inside. So now, being incredibly stupid, she thinks, shit.
It only makes sense.
I'm going to get another car because it worked out so well the first time.
Think of this. Just sitting here waiting for me.
Not once did the radars go off and she's like, it's a bad idea. Nope. So she hops in. She starts the truck and then she realizes, oh, shit, it's a stick shift. And I can't fucking drive one.
How many times have we come across this?
I think at least a second or third.
I think the best deterrent, if you don't want your car stolen, buy a standard freaking car.
Apparently.
I didn't even realize they were still making them. They are.
Yeah, you can request them. I don't think they come standard per se.
Yes.
Pun not intended on that one, but you can find them, but I think most people don't want one.
I think you get a special order them now. Back in the day, that was just what you got.
So after she realizes the stick shift, she just hops out. But the car's rolling. So the car rolls into a hydrant. So she gets arrested again for motor vehicle theft, careless driving, driving without a license, and failing to report the crash. She didn't even really steal the car.
So she's back where she started from.
It's just she was out of jail for, I'm guessing, about 8 minutes.
It gets lonely out there.
Yeah, it does. When I was reading that, I was thinking, you know, you see movies like The Score, The Italian Job, or Goodfellas, whatever. They could have these heists that are so well planned out, you know, meticulous right down to the last detail. She doesn't even bother seeing what kind of fucking
I think, though, nowadays you hop in a car, if you see it's a stick shift, you're pretty shocked right away.
Yeah.
Right off the get-go.
I haven't driven one in at least 15 years. I think I still could. For sure, I know how to drive one, but it's been a while.
It's been a while. My brother actually has one. Because he's 100 years old. And I drove his probably a few years back. But I learned on a stick shift. That was the first car I had was a stick shift.
So did I. Yeah.
It's because they were cheap.
One of my friend's moms was away a lot for work. And she had a stick shift. And we would drive it. We didn't have permission. We were like 13.
You stole a stick shift.
Sort of. But that's how we learned to drive. And she'd always be like, was my car in a different spot? We're like, no. No.
I used to take my mom's car, and you had to map that stuff out. How many clicks the seat was back? She used to set
and
that.
Then you got to roll the odometer.
She used to push the button to set it to zero. So, which was the worst thing she could do because you knew once you get in, you just got to push it back to zero.
Yeah, but you got the mileage odometer though. You can't.
She never paid attention. She couldn't remember those numbers.
Some cars you could roll it in reverse. You know, put them up on blocks and roll it in reverse and take the mileage.
I wouldn't
off.
Have gone through that kind of
they
effort.
I think they tried that on Ferris Bueller's Day Off, but you could.
They
do
did,
that.
We and they went out the back
we
of the
used
garage.
To do that, yeah.
Yeah. Actually, when I left for the military, I was 17 when I joined the military. The day I was leaving, I gave her keys to her car.
I remember. Yeah,
she's like, what are these? I'm like, they're keys to your car. They are not. Oh, I promise you they are.
I remember her telling me that. There was a little twinkle of pride in her eye. Right. She was appalled and kind of impressed.
She was in the shower one day, and I'm like, I yoinked those keys. I ran down to the downtown. We had a hardware store, made a copy of that key, brought him back, had him back before she knew it. It was a nice Toyota Celica. It was a sweet car.
It was a sweet car.
Yeah. Put some miles on that bad boy.
Next up, we've got a guy named Joshua Lee, who rented a Tesla Model 3 from Hertz for a weekend trip in L.A. And in his rental paperwork, he checked the box for skip the pump and save time. After he returned the car, he was hit with a refuel charge of $277.39.
A refuel charge? He got charged for gasoline.
Yes.
On a Tesla.
Yep.
The company wasn't backing down either.
So even if a Tesla had a gas tank, which it doesn't, he checked the box, skipped the pump. So he paid extra to skip the pump.
So he didn't have to fill it back up.
Regardless, if it had a humongous tank and it was empty, he still shouldn't have had to pay them a fucking dime. He already paid them for that.
And how much did they charge him? 300 what, 77 or something like that?
$277.39. That's a fuckload of money, though.
To fill a gas tank. Should have cost like $40.
When he pressed Hertz for details, they would not waive the fee. He returned the car with a 95% charge, which is exactly the charge he picked it up with. So the car was full charge.
The car was full.
So to charge at 5%, apparently it cost $277. Now, Tesla's charge, their charge if they need to fully charge a car is $35.
Yeah.
And he returned it basically fully charged. So they charged him $277.39. So he repeatedly reached out to them, and then Hertz responded to his concerns with the following tidbit of wisdom.
Yeah.
This is from them. I am unable to provide an adjustment or a refund since the service was provided and the contract is closed. Your signed rental agreement will also be our basis that you were fully aware of the fuel option that was added on your contract. I hope I was able to clarify this for you. Thank you for allowing me to review and assist you with your concerns.
So when they point out the fact that he actually paid extra to not have to fill it up. So that's why they're charging him for not filling it up. But he did fill. He did charge it up.
He did charge it up. So let me summarize the email for you. I don't give a fuck. fuck you.
Oh, you know that person did not give jack shit of a care for
they
that
probably
guy.
Just get a raise and a promotion. Yeah. I like the way you do business.
Stupid COVID made everybody fucking stupid.
That guy got screwed. That's just terrible business. Oh. Just terrible business. He did everything right as a customer and still got fucked.
Oh, I've been screwed over by Hertz. They're good at it. I got to pay for damage to a car that I didn't damage because I didn't go around and check the shit. My fault, I guess.
Did you check, skip the pump, and save time?
I would never do that. I would have never checked anything extra. Insurance? Nope.
What are the odds I'm going to need that?
Right? Yep. $500 later, I should have checked that box.
All right. What do we got going on this week?
So this week, I am going to talk about the Silk Road. Not the one that some of you... I actually thought a lot of people knew about the Silk Road.
I'm not familiar with that one.
And it's not the Silk Road that you're thinking of back in the day, but actually we'll get into it. But I thought more people knew about it. I asked around and a lot of people were unaware of the Silk Road.
Yeah, I have no idea what you're talking about. I know the historical one you're talking about, but not what you're talking about.
All right. So this one is going to be Slicker Than Silk, Ross Ulrich and the Silk Road.
All right. Looking forward to it. Be right back.
Do you know what the most frightening thing in the world is?
All right, we're going to start with the Britannica. That's the encyclopedia.
Thanks, I was confused.
I don't think everybody remembers that that's an encyclopedia. They don't have those anymore.
Yeah, people just quote Wikipedia now.
Yeah, exactly. Britannica is actually supposed to be factual, and Wikipedia is all over the place. Yeah. The Silk Road was an ancient trade route that linked the Western world with the Middle East and Asia. It was a major conduit for trade between the Roman Empire and China, and later between the medieval European kingdoms and China. Fast forward to 2011, and once again ask, what is the Silk Road? Well, to understand the Silk Road, first you need to understand what is the dark web. Who created it and how do you get on it? So we're going to learn today.
I've been curious. Let me take some notes.
So the dark web or deep web is the entire internet. Not just what you see through search engines like Google, Yahoo, or Bing. The only way to enter the dark web is through something called Tor. Tor is software that works like a web browser. Tor was created by who? Oh, that's right, the U.S. Navy, to help secure communications over the internet. So all this dark web stuff you hear about is all created by our government. So it was made so their messages and orders and such could be sent back and forth without the fear of them being intercepted. Once a person enters Tor, they can't be traced because all your information is hidden, such as your IP address and personal information.
Not familiar with that word. How do you spell that, Tor?
I think it's just T-O-R-R. I have it spelt in the story like probably 7 or 8 different ways. That's how I roll.
Believe it or not, I've never been on the dark web. I know of it, but I've never.
Well, you have.
I've never, maybe.
The whole thing is people don't realize that the dark web is the internet. It's just when you're accessing it, it's... When you go through Tor, it scatters your IP.
Most of the really sketchy shit is not available. Is that correct? Is it just
the stuff is there? You can't access it unless you have the software.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, if you're not on a search engine, you're on the dark web. You know what I mean? If you're not going through that, you're a lot of just from what I was reading, what I understand, a lot of your like just regular internet. Like if you have a web page or whatever, existing on – it's either the dark or deep web.
I basically use Google, so I can't access what you're talking about.
Not through Google. Yeah, you'd have to download Tor.
Yeah.
So once a person enters Tor, they can't be traced because all the information is hidden. Like I said, your IP address, personal information, you can't see any of it. Once in Tor, though, you must know where you're going. It's not a search engine. You can't just do a web search for the activity that you're looking for. You can't type in, you know, drugs, and then it's going to pull up a bunch of drug stuff. So like I said, addresses are typically a random bunch of letters and numbers followed by something like .onion. .onion is pretty typical on the...
Really?
Yeah. So enter Ross Ulbricht. Ross was born March 27th, 1984 in Austin, Texas. Ross was always known to be a good kid. a Boy Scout even. He climbed the ranks up to Eagle Scout. After finishing high school, he earned a scholarship to study physics at the University of Texas. While in school, he fell in love with a young lady. By 2006, it was time for him to graduate, and he proposed to his then-girlfriend, the love of his life. But she confessed to him. Turns out, she'd been stacking dicks on dicks. The little lady'd been sowing some serious oats. So that was the end of the wedding chatter. Ross called it off and headed home, now looking for what was next in life. So he decided to head back to college to pursue his master's degree at Penn State University. This guy's no dummy. He's a very intelligent guy. Once again, he received a full ride scholarship. While at Penn State, Ross got interested in libertarianism. He believed that whatever a person did to themselves was up to them. Minimal government interference in an individual's life. I used to think I was a libertarian. And I think in some things it goes a little too far for me.
Yeah.
I thought I was. I am for less government, but true libertarianism, yeah, I was wrong.
A lot of ideologies, I think people like this, don't like that. It's hard to find something
you really fully identify
with in all aspects.
Yeah, I'm all about the less interference and this and that.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So, Ross completely changed his life after this. He actually lived in a basement that he had gotten rent-free. He wore clothes that he had gotten free from a friend's thrift store. Basically, he became a minimalist. And a real cheap ass, actually. While in school, Ross met a younger girl by the name of Jessica. The two of them soon began dating. Over time, Ross's libertarian beliefs grew. He believed that people should be able to do what they wanted, including drugs. He believed all drugs should be legalized. He believed that if they were legalized, they'd actually become less dangerous. There might be something to that, you know? I don't know that that's actually true, but you'll understand why he thought it. Ross had the idea of a free trade market that he wanted to implement, but he wasn't sure how. After graduating with his master's degree, he decided he wanted to be an entrepreneur, and he actually ended up starting his own business selling used books online. So he was going to be the next Jeff Bezos. He would get his books for free. You know, people would donate books, and then they would put them online, sell them, or they would donate them to different prisons and stuff. It was a nonprofit.
Yeah.
For now, it was.
Not a lot of money in used books.
No.
I read a lot, but the value of it, unless it's rare or something.
Well, I mean, if you're getting
the value is minimal.
It's not bad when you're getting your inventory for free.
It is.
It's like Goodwill, you know?
Shipping and handling is going to have to be on the buyer, and then you get a small margin. I get it. I mean, there's not a ton of money to be made.
But if it's a nonprofit, you can't be pulling shit. For a couple of years, he'd been thinking of ways to put his libertarian views into use. So, I mean, Ross wasn't like a materialistic dude. They said he lived out of like two trash bags. He lived, like I said, in a basement. He didn't have to pay shit for. He
showed
didn't
up
care.
Like Ricky Snitty with a.
Yeah.
Don't be the trash bag. Yeah.
So. For a couple of years, he'd been thinking of ways to put his libertarian views into use. He had the idea of a seastead, a permanent home based at sea, outside the regulations of any government. As much as he liked the idea, it would be hard to turn into reality. But Ross had always been good with a computer. He always had his laptop. Most of the money he made came from computer work he would find on Craigslist. But Ross, he did start that used bookstore, and it went by the name of Good Wagon Books. Ross found a way to make his idea come to reality. He learned from an acquaintance online that he could make his free trade website online and not get caught. Ross soon learned about the dark web and Tor. So this was part one for Ross. He now knew that he could create a website that would be untraceable, but also knew this wasn't true when it came to payment. In this country, if you're going to pay for something online, they can trace the shit out of that. But not long after that, Ross came upon the solution. Bitcoin. So now I'm a cryptocurrency guy. And nowadays you hear about Bitcoin and they always say, oh, that's Bitcoin's just for drug you know, or people that buy drugs and do this and that.
Yeah.
You could pretty much blame that on Ross here. Yeah. This the Bitten Point got its bad name from Ross, as far as I'm concerned. And I think a lot of the case the government tried this was more about the Bitcoin than it was the drugs.
IRS is going to get theirs, man.
Oh, yeah.
Always.
Bitcoin would allow people to make payments without being traced. It could be traded peer-to-peer without knowing who it was coming from. Ross worked on building a website for over a year. He taught himself how to program and code. So, like I said, this guy's no dummy. He literally taught himself how to code, how to program, and built a website like an Amazon-type website. Amazon or eBay at the time.
Yeah.
He built the entire thing by himself. The only person that he told about the site was a friend from the University of Texas who was a programmer. When Ross had any problems, he'd call Richard and ask him, and he'd help him work through whatever. But he never told him what the website was for, supposedly. And Richard claims he never asked. He just said it was top secret.
Bullshit.
Yeah, well.
You knew
it. I don't recall. Throughout this time, Ross remained with Julia, and the two of them got an apartment in Austin, Texas, where Ross did freelance computer work, and Julia had her own photography business. Ross did let Julia know about the website. She didn't like the idea, but she did nothing to change Ross's plans. One day, Ross took her to another apartment. In this apartment, Ross revealed his plan. The apartment was full of trays of mushrooms. These weren't the kind of mushrooms you bought in the grocery store. The kind of mushrooms you found on a pile of cow shit. These were magic mushrooms. Yeah. The good stuff. Ross's plan was to sell mushrooms on his new website. Julia didn't like the idea, but once again, let Ross go about his business. Ross set up an account for Julia and set out to make his first transaction. He typed in the web address, and this here was the actual web. I mean, I said it was random numbers and stuff. This was the actual web address for the Silk Road. TYDGCCYKIXPBU6UZED.onion. The Silk Road. Ross went through the website with her and how it worked. He informed her that a person would have to purchase with Bitcoin and explained to her it was like buying tokens at an arcade, which is a good way to explain it. You'd have to go somewhere, purchase your Bitcoin, take that Bitcoin, bring it to the Silk Road, purchase the drugs with the Bitcoin, right? And there's more to it than that, but that's basically how it works. The same idea as like being in an arcade. You got to go get your tokens.
Yeah.
So he went through start to finish with Julia, from going to the site, buying the Bitcoin, using the Bitcoin to purchase drugs on the Silk Road. So Ross knew right off the get-go that he needed to advertise. People needed to find out about this, or no one's going to, you know anything. But you can't put an ad out on anything. Hey, selling drugs on the internet. So
looking for some crack.
Right? So the first post, Ross decided to go make some posts. What he did, the first post was handwritten. I mean, not handwritten. It's hard to handwrite on a computer. The first post Ross had written on January 27, 2011, he'd gone through a magic mushrooms forum called the Shroomery and registered an account under the name Altoid. He posted the following message, quote, "I came across this website called Silk Road. It's a Tor hidden service that claims to allow you to buy and sell anything online anonymously. I'm thinking of buying off it, but wanted to see if anyone here had heard of it and could recommend it. I found it through silkroad420.wordpress.com, which, if you have a Tor browser, directs you to the real site. Let me know what you think." 2 days later, January 29th, 2011, Ross made a second post on bitcointalk.com. This is back when Bitcoin was brand new.
Yeah.
The particular thread that Ross posted in was a discussion about using Bitcoin to buy and sell heroin.
I don't think I'd even heard of Bitcoin back in 2011.
You know what? My son brought up Bitcoin to me around that time. He's like, "Dad, you should buy some Bitcoin." And I'm like, "Oh, okay." It was worth a dollar then.
Yeah.
Bitcoin last month hit $73,250 a Bitcoin. I've been a fucking millionaire.
Oops.
So this was Ross's post, the second post in that forum. What an awesome thread you guys have. A ton of great ideas. Has anyone seen Silk Road yet? It's kind of like an anonymous Amazon.com. And I don't think they have heroin, but they are selling other stuff. They basically use Bitcoin and Tor to broker anonymous transactions. Those not familiar with Tor can go to silkroad420.wordpress.com for instructions on how to access a .onion site. Let me know what you guys think. So this is how he went about advertising the Silk Road. So you put something out like that, and all these people who are computer guys are like, they got to check this shit out, you know? This was the start of the Silk Road. Several people visited the site at first without buying. Right now, the only thing that's on the site is Ross's magic mushrooms. But this site isn't limited to just Ross selling his mushrooms. Different people can register, and they can sell their goods, and other people can buy them from them. So
it's like a little drug flea market.
It's just like he said. It's like an Amazon or like eBay or Amazon.com. People weren't, you know, on eBay when that first started. You were bidding and stuff like that. It was an auction. It wasn't that, but the site was very similar. Several people visited the site at first, but they didn't buy anything. But before you knew it, they began to purchase and selling their own drugs on the website. These same people began to promote the site itself. And a month later, the site had over 100 registered users. 6.23% was what Ross got per transaction. It was on. The type of drugs on the website expanded. It went from just weed and psychedelics to cocaine and heroin, speed, you name it. Ross had added a rating system to the Silk Road. So this is kind of the way he thought it would be safer. So he added a rating system, which allowed people to rate the transactions they had. And if you had a bad rating, people were unlikely to buy from you on just like on eBay at the time.
Yeah.
So if you got a rating, a 2-star or whatever, and it wasn't just as easy as just – it probably was at first, but as it went on, it wasn't as easy to just like go create a new account and start over, you know.
It's probably as much as if somebody sketched you out, so to speak, like, you know, you get a bad vibe from somebody. I'm sure you.
But these weren't face to face transactions.
No, I mean, but somebody asking too many questions. You would assume that kind of form. Yeah. Everybody's really wary of a cop or whatever. So
absolutely,
if somebody gives you bad vibes, you know, they're going to get a shit.
And when he created this website, it wasn't just the selling; it had forums.
Yeah.
So people would go in there and discuss stuff in the forums and stuff. It was a community. It was a big community in the end. So, a journalist from the online website Gawker came across the thread talking about the Silk Road. Soon after, an article came out from Gawker about the Silk Road. Almost overnight, the website went from 1,000 registered, it was up to 1,000 now, 1,000 registered users to 10,000 registered users. The article also caught the attention of Senator Chuck Schumer, who's still the senator today. This was in 2011. This began a chain of investigations by every branch of the government you can think of. But this also blew the fucking site up. You know, soon after this, the site was just going crazy. Ross began to have some serious problems with the site from Bitcoin disappearing and other technical problems. Remember, Ross was a self-taught programmer.
Yeah.
He actually had to set the site down for a few days to try to fix a problem in his code. See, what had happened is there was like a shopping cart. You can't, when there's shopping cart ads on the, I didn't know this. I found this from this case. But like when you go to Amazon, they probably own their own now. But when it first started, there's a shopping cart app.
Yeah.
And that the shopping cart part, when you put your stuff in there, they would take a little bit of the transaction. Right. Yeah. And they charged that on the transaction. So the company paid that. Well, Ross couldn't use one of those to sell drugs. So he stole the code from it. But the code was still trying to take its percentage of the Bitcoin. So it was being lost into the ether. It was just disappearing. So he was actually losing money, almost bankrupt the site before it started. So soon after restarting the Silk Road, other types of products started showing up, such as firearms and other weapons. This caused increased tension with Ross and Julia. She did not believe that you should be selling any type of weapon or allowing other type of weapons to be sold on the website. Ross was all consumed with the Silk Road. This drove a wedge between the two of them. Eventually, this led to Julia giving Ross an ultimatum, her or the Silk Road. Ross chose the Silk Road. But actually, after this, Julia was off with him, and Julia remained friends. And Julia was off getting drunk. Oh, no, she was getting high with one of her friends. She probably bought some the old Sticky Iggy off of the Silk Road.
Off the Silk Road, yeah.
Yeah. And so she was with her friend Erica, and she actually told Erica about the about Ross and his website. And actually, I think that same night, her and Erica ended up getting into a fight, and Ross had to throw Erica out of the apartment, right? So the first thing Erica does, she goes to Ross's Facebook page and puts a post up. Oh, how do you think the cops would feel about your drug website? And posted it on Facebook. So Ross sees this and panics. He's actually able to take it down off of his site, but he has to call Erica and like apologize for everything and backpedal. And, you know, he was actually crying. He was so afraid that he was going to get in trouble for all of it. So Erica agreed that she wasn't going to say anything about it. She forgave him. And that was the end of that for there. But that was his first scare. But security became a real problem on the site for Ross. Since Ross built the site himself, there were several security holes and coding problems. He ended up getting hacked several times. He was pretty much helpless. If someone hacked him, he pretty much had to give in to their demands.
What are you going to call the FBI?
Yeah, right? And, I mean, he wasn't a computer programmer, so there's guys out there that could get into this no problem at all, you know?
I'm not one of them.
No, me either. So Ross is forced to consult with Richard on problems that come up on the site. In the meantime, the site continues to explode, growing faster than Ross can handle. Along the way, Ross befriends an individual on the site who goes by the name Variety Jones. He consults with Variety over several different things about the website, and the two become close. Variety gives Ross a lot of advice on how to run the site. He ends up working for him. He brought to him several times different security issues, and it was Variety Jones's idea that Ross should go by the name Dread Pirate Roberts. This is a beloved character from the movie The Princess Bride. Did you ever watch Princess Bride?
Long time ago.
I never did actually see it. And I know a lot of people freaking roast me for that.
You're going to get booed for that.
But so the Dread Pirate Roberts is a pirate who goes by that name. But he'll step down and somebody else will step up and they become the Dread Pirate Roberts. So it's a continuous cycle of Dread Pirate Roberts. But it's a different person who takes the role. This is done with the hope that people will believe it's not the same person running the show from the start to finish. And that comes up later on. So Variety Jones pretty much becomes Ross's, or the Dread Pirate Roberts, right-hand man.
Now, is he related to Motherfucker Jones?
They're cousins. It's the motherfucking facts. Variety Jones is a registered seller on the website. No one there really knows that he's the Dread Pirate Roberts' right-hand man. Nobody's aware, you know. Variety helps police the site for Ross. He's on the payroll, though.
Yeah, for sure.
There's a lot of infighting going on within the chats on the site, so Ross is forced to hire moderators to help police things. So he actually has to bring on staff because it's like they're getting out of control. The guys who are on there selling what it started out, they were selling guns and stuff on there.
Yeah.
The drug people didn't like the gun people. The gun people didn't like the drug people. Some drug people were fighting with each other. So they had to bring in moderators to moderate.
You tell me the scumbags aren't getting along. No, I don't believe
it. You know what's funny? If you have to bring in a moderator, doesn't that kind of go against the libertarian beliefs? You got to moderate what the people are say and not say.
We're going to need some government here.
Right? Isn't that exactly?
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah, it is. You're governing. Yeah.
This anarchy's not working out. I'm going to have to bring in some government.
So Ross requires the moderators to send him copies of their identification. So Ross knows knows their real identities while he remains anonymous, or as the Dread Pirate Roberts. While this is going down, a DHS agent by the name Jared Derjegheim,
who nailed that for sure.
He broke it down into phonetic. I fucked that up. the name right and then fuck up the word after.
Don't you put that in your podcast.
So he worked out of the Chicago. Sorry.
Nobody,
Jared worked out
even
of.
Noticed. You're fine.
I think I'm good. We know Ryan won't edit that out.
No fucking chance.
So Jared, who worked out of Chicago, began to notice an influx of drugs coming through the airport. He found several employees. Excuse me. He found several envelopes, small envelopes, with one single pill inside of them. Jared was brand new in his job, but he was a pretty bright dude. He began to know what to look for. With these different envelopes coming through, and he was able to pinpoint when the drugs were coming. So Jared started making waves with his supervisors, kind of pissing everybody off. You know, this is a new guy, and he's on the case, you know. So Jared discovers a link between the packages coming through and the Silk Road, which he was the first one to really. I mean, there's all these people out there, these agencies that are supposed to be investigating this, but nobody's actually booking cases against the Silk Road. Everybody seems to think everybody is, but nobody is. Jared was actually the first to book a case against it.
Yeah.
At this point, Jared was pretty much the only person making cases towards the Silk Road. He began reaching out for help from other departments. Enter Carl Mark Force. That's his name. Carl Mark Force.
You gotta be a badass if that's your name.
He's a DEA agent who's currently riding the pine due to a drinking problem. Instead of getting rid of Carl, they just gave him a desk job. Isn't that how it works in the government jobs? Oh, you want some help with your case? We'll give you Carl. Carl was one of the agents given the case. Each agency seemed to have their own agent working the case of the Silk Road. The FBI had Chris Tarbell, Assistant DA Turner, and oddly enough, an IRS agent by the name, like you said before, the IRS wants theirs. There was an IRS agent by the name Gary Alford. Gary actually does a Google search for the Silk Road, and for the time frame, it was like 2011, and when it first came on the market, you know, and he narrows his search down to just a few hits, and all of these hits he's getting are literally from these small drug websites like the Sugary, where he sees the post by a guy say, "Hey, you guys should go check out the Silk Road." It's by a guy that goes by the handle Altoid. Gary follows the trail on these posts. Most of the posts are going from an account by the name Frosty. But one of the trails he follows comes up with an account on a Bitcoin forum where Ross has made the mistake of using his own Gmail account.
Oh, man.
Literally, rossalbrich@gmail.com.
Oh, man.
Boom, right? Nope, not yet. A task force is formed to bring all the agencies together to share information and shut down the Silk Road. The FBI is leading the way with the task force with a ton of information on the site. Jared was also on the team and presented his case and all the information that he had about the Silk Road. Our man Gary, the IRS man, is taking you can't like Gary.
Nope. Gary sucks.
Nothing about Carl, but Gary sucks. So Gary is taken aback by all the information the different organizations have on the Silk Road. You know, he's kind of thinking the little bit that he has is insignificant in comparison. You know, these guys have got these they got this whole case laid out, all the pills coming in, and he did a Google search, you know. So he says nothing about the name he came across during his short investigation, and he keeps it in his back pocket. So literally, Gary cracked the entire fucking case just like that, but sits on it
and doesn't
follow up. So, you know, he gets, I think, overwhelmed by what's happening. Is like, now, you know.
Maybe he didn't recognize the scope of what he discovered.
Exactly.
You could assume if all these agencies are working, you didn't crack it with a fucking Google search.
Yeah. You would think, but
I bet that type of stuff happens all the time.
Oh, I bet it does.
Somebody stumbles on a humongous nugget but doesn't recognize it for what it is.
I'm 100% sure. So this task force is no different than any other government team that's been created. Nobody wants to give up the information to each other because each one of them wants to make their name off of solving the case.
Yeah, Yeah, they want to break the big boy.
Yep. Each agency refuses to tell the next what they have. Soon after the meeting, the FBI gets information. Okay, soon after the meeting, I'm sorry, I lost my spot. Soon after the meeting, the FBI got some really big information, and no one knows how they really got this. So it seemed kind of shady. But they get a thumb drive from the Icelandic authorities from a server in Iceland that was hosting the Silk Road. So some shady shit was happening with the government. Okay, go figure, right? People think that this was the NSA that actually did this, but... So this is from Wikipedia. And on May 2013, the Silk Road was taken down for a short period of time by a sustained DDoS attack. I had to look up what that was. It was a denial of service attack. On the 23rd June 2013, it was first reported that the DEA seized 11 Bitcoin. So at that time, that was probably only a few bucks. Oh, wait, it was right here. Then worth a total of $814. So big, you can do the math. Which the media suspected was the result of the Silk Road honeypot sting. The FBI had claimed that the real IP address of the Silk Road server was found via a data leak directly from the site's capture. And it was located in Iceland. So that's where they're claiming that it came from. You know, they get this thumb drive that's a copy of the entire thing from the Icelandic whatever. And you talk to different people who know the shit about computers, like, that's not possible. There's no way you got it from the capture. How did they capture? The CAPTCHA. You know what those are when you're going in, putting your stuff in.
Yeah.
So IT experts have doubted the FBI's claim because technical evidence suggests that no misconfiguration that could cause that specific leak was present at the time. So shady. The government was going through these things without a warrant is what it was.
Bullshit. Bullshit.
Well, they do that a lot through this case. This case is shady.
Our government follows the rules by the book.
All the time.
You are mistaken, my friend.
With this copy of the server, they're able to see everything going on the Silk Road. At this point, they could have taken over and shut it all down. But nope. They wanted the man responsible. For this, they're able to find the IP address for the Silk Road. This was a login that happened in San Francisco at a local coffee shop. It showed that the Silk Road had been accessed via their Wi-Fi. Another department in the FBI during the same time intercepted a package containing 9 IDs. Each ID had the same person's picture with different names. 2 agents are assigned to go look into the case. The picture on all of these IDs is Ross Ulbricht. The agents on the case head to the address on the package to investigate. When the agents knock on Ross's apartment door, they notice the man at the door matches the picture on all the IDs. Ross sees the agent and immediately believes he's busted. He asks the agents if he could help them, and they explain to him about the package that they received with the 9 identifications. They tell Ross that they're not looking to arrest him, but are more interested in where someone could obtain these type of IDs. So they want the source, you know. He's the little guy. They want to go after the big guy. So, basically, you tell us where you got them, no charges will be pressed. Ross tells the agents, oh, shit, man, you can get on these on the Silk Road. The officers have no idea what the Silk Road is, because this was completely... on the outside of what, you know, this investigation wasn't connected to the Silk Road at all. So Ross actually walks him through how they can go on, buy fake IDs, or anything that they want off the Silk Road. The agents take Ross's information and are on their way. Tuesday. All right, so we're going to stop this one right here. We're going to have to make this a two-parter. I got quite a ways to go still. So... sorry to do this to you, but we will drop the second episode on Tuesday, so you won't have to wait till next week.
I'm going to leave you hanging for
a couple days.
4 days?
Yeah, for a few days. But I want to make sure I get it all in there. This will end up being way too long if we do it in just
one. It's a good story. You don't want to hear. You don't want to hurry this one. It's a good one.
So I guess we will now take you to the fire pit. But before we go, if you guys have any stories, we've gotten a few from you guys, and we appreciate you, those of you that have stepped up and got us some stories when you're a little worried about it. But, you know, a little nervous. You guys have nothing to be nervous about. You can't mess up more than I do. Go back, rewind just a few minutes. But no, send your stories in. BeyondTheShadows207@gmail.com. Or you can send them to us on the socials. We just got one on our socials. And yeah.
Don't be shy. We're a shadow family. We're not going to judge it. We love your show. We love hearing from you guys. Send them in here. And we know you guys have a bunch of good stories.
Yeah,
get them in.
Get them in. So we'll catch you in the fire pit.
I guess you know what time it is. Let's get into that fire pit.
So this week's fire pit comes to us from Kadra, from Perplexity, a mystery podcast.
Hello, everyone. My name is Kadra, and I am the host of Perplexity, a mystery podcast. Every week on my podcast, I cover all things mysterious. So I talk about the paranormal, cryptids, true crime, mysterious disappearances, psychological phenomenon, cults, and much more. So I would love if you joined me over wherever you get your podcasts, or you can watch me on YouTube. The story that I am telling around the campfire today is one that it happened to me when I was in college. It has been featured on the Let's Not Meet podcast before, so if it sounds familiar, that is why. So this happened to me while I was in graduate school. And at that time, I lived in an off-campus student living apartment complex. I also worked at this place part-time. And one evening when I was home alone, I had a small two-bedroom apartment. My randomly assigned roommate was not home. So I don't remember exactly what I was doing, but I got interrupted by a knock at the door by someone I didn't know. Quick backstory here. I had gotten out of a really abusive relationship about 2 years prior, and that relationship, I had met that guy at the same apartment complex. Luckily, the guy had moved away, but I always worried one day he might come back, he might find me. And ever since that relationship, I've been on high alert. So when I heard this knock at the door, I wasn't expecting anybody. So I immediately planned to not open the door. We did have little peepholes. So I walked up and checked the peephole, and I walked as quietly to the door as I could. And when I looked through the peephole, I saw a man standing there, but I couldn't really see his face because it was dark. So there's like a large silhouette of him. Couldn't really make out any details of his face or his body, just this large shadow. But he was wearing some type of baseball cap, and I called out through the door, "Hello." And I just remember he said, "Pizza delivery," in like a really calm, matter-of-fact tone. I didn't recognize the voice, so I was partially relieved because I knew it wasn't my crazy ex-boyfriend, but I was still pretty scared because when I was looking at him, while I couldn't really make out any details about him, I could tell that this wasn't just some type of mix-up where he went to the wrong apartment, because it was very clear he was not holding anything. There was no pizza in his hands. So it's like he was trying to lure me under false pretenses to open the door. So I don't remember exactly what I said. I said something like, you know, I didn't order a pizza, or you've got the wrong apartment. And when I said that, the tone and this guy's voice immediately changed. And he was like, "Are you sure?" And I remember just getting full body chills, and my heart started beating really fast. adrenaline starting to go through me, and I'm starting to think about if I need to call 911. So I told him to leave immediately or that I was going to call the cops. And he surprisingly listened. He didn't say anything after that I can remember. He just left. I did not open the door. I still kept everything locked. And I remember even like looking out the peephole for several minutes just to see if he would come back, and nothing happened. So flash forward, a couple hours later, my roommate came home and I told her what happened. She hadn't been expecting anybody. And since I also worked at this apartment complex, I told my coworkers about it and I told my manager about it when I was working my shift the next day. And my manager told me that there were similar incidences happening around the complex to other female tenants. And she even said that one girl in particular called the front office the morning of the day that this happens to me. And she was super freaked out because she said a man followed her to her car and started banging on her window, trying to get her to open the door. And then my manager was like, I'm going to keep an eye on this for now, like something like that, because she didn't want to scare anyone, is what she said. So she didn't want to send out an alert and have people, quote unquote, scared for no reason. And I remember that really pissing me off, because it's kind of like when the police know about a crime and they don't want the public to freak out, quote unquote, so they don't say anything. It's just such a bullshit thing to me. I feel like she was just trying to cover her ass, and it really upset me. But I was also kind of naive. I was like 23 at the time, so I didn't report anything to police either. I just continued to kind of be on the lookout for this guy, but I never saw him again. I didn't hear anything. So about a week goes by, and I believe while I was working, another resident came in, a female, and she had some concerns to give to our manager. And she ended up filing a police report because a man snuck into her apartment while she was home alone. And so come to find out, this girl was taking a shower when she heard a rustling in her apartment. And she knew that her roommates were not home, so she immediately felt like something was off. And when she peeked out of her shower curtain, she saw a large figure pass by the reflection in the mirror. So she's just standing there, terrified, in the shower. And after a couple minutes, a man's hand emerged from the other side of the shower curtain and ripped the shower curtain open. So she starts screaming. She's yelling, you know, get out, get out, get out. And she's just kind of standing there screaming, you know, like, what are you supposed to do? And she said that this man just stared at her body. And he didn't say anything. He just stared at her like a complete creep. And then he ran out of the front door. And she said later, she figured he must have got in through the front door because it was unlocked. And that's the thing about these student living apartment complexes, is like, we have these randomly assigned roommates, or we have people coming and going all the time. So this guy seemed to know that this was like a vulnerable complex, a place that he could have easier access to take advantage of females. So after all this happened, there was a police report written up, but the police didn't seem, from what I could gather, to do anything after that, because there were no patrols around the apartment complex. There was no additional security, but our manager did conveniently send out after this, like a warning email to the residents. But weeks went by, months went by. Nothing else seemed to happen. And one day I randomly get a text message from a coworker with a link to an article. So I click on this article, and it starts to describe how a man in his early 30s was recently caught, arrested, and he was going to be convicted right by our campus for sexually assaulting multiple women and breaking into people's homes. And in the article, he blamed his behavior on his addiction to porn, which is a whole other ridiculous story. But some of the victims were choked by this man. The police also said they had reason to believe he was connected to a slew of other assaults throughout this area, including sexual assaults of several other female college students and two sexual assaults of sex workers. And this man was a custodian at our local college. So he was charged, and as far as I know, he was put away, hopefully for a long time, but I'm skeptical because in a lot of sexual assaults, the time does not fit the crime, in my opinion. And it's clear that this guy would have escalated. I don't know if this is true, but there were also some rumors that he raped a girl that was at our complex. And I just can't help but think about what may have happened if I would have let my guard down for 2 seconds and I would have opened the door, or if he would have not listened to me when I told him to leave, like if he would have broken my window or come back, found another way in. And I'm also very glad that my roommate wasn't home, because if she would have been, I may have thought it was one of her friends or something. So all that to say, I feel like I'm not glad I have a history of abuse, but I do like to think it made me more cognizant of my surroundings that day. And yeah, that is my true crime campfire story. And if you want to hear more from me, check me out on Perplexity, a mystery podcast. I tell tales that perplex me every Wednesday. And I'm very passionate about the cases that I cover, especially the true crime ones. I really try to honor the victims and present the stories in a compelling way that makes you think about all the perplexing possibilities of the mystery. I would love to have you over there. And if you do give me a listen, let me know that Beyond the Shadows sent you. And yeah, thanks for listening.
Thanks for the story, Cade.
Wow, that's a crazy story. That's scary.
It is. Yeah. Good
Thank God you didn't open that door.
Good on her for sniffing out that guy's creepiness. But that's appalling to the people that ran the housing.
Nobody wants to do anything to until it's too late.
Yeah, just ignore it. And, and that happens all the time. You get all these big red flags and everybody ignores it until something really appalling happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then they're like, oh, oops, we missed the red flags. Yeah. But yeah, this guy is obviously a creepy fuck. He was doing it all over the place and nobody did anything. It probably could have
been busted way before any of that happened.
Because nobody wants to get in on it. No, you shouldn't be knocking on doors. You shouldn't be knocking on doors. Somebody busted the dude, you know? Yeah. Do your job is what it boils down to. Do your job.
Absolutely. We really appreciate you sending that story to us, Kadra. We really want you guys to go over, check out her podcast. She does a great job. Check it out. Like she says, she puts a lot into it. She really does a good job. So
absolutely.
Check her out, and we will catch you guys in the next one.
Later, guys.
Hello, Beyond the Shadows listeners.
I am Rachel.
And I'm Heather.
We are the hosts of Like Mother, Like Murder.
We bring you the good, the badass, and the crime.
Each week, we bring you stories from missing and murdered,
to survivors and women who empower you.
And of course, some mom talk sprinkled in.
Check us out wherever you get your podcasts at Like Mother, Like Murder.
And give us a follow on social media so that we can say hi.
K love you, bye.
K love you, bye.